Welcome to my conversation facilitation house, Johnny Pollard, who's a beautiful man, friend of mine, very dear. He's a what the Indians call a guru because he shines light on darkness, and he is all around snazzy motherfucker who's awake as shit. His main occupation is being a meditation teacher, which he actually taught me Vedic meditation. So I would 100% recommend all. Hello, Johnny.
Hello, Jeremy.
I always feel so happy around you. As we know, these podcasts, who knows where they'll go? I don't. You don't. No one does. But I'm interested in the conversation around everyone's perception of God at the moment. But I'd love to get your perspective or wisdom on what it actually is in a more, you know,
right? Because I am the absolute authority.
No, just because I think people have this idea of a guy with a beard up in the cloud and it's a he, and all these ideas, like kind of just reducing it back to the essence as far back as you know or can sense as to what this energy is that we deem to be God and how it's become framed in the way it has been framed and then largely misunderstood in the way it's been misunderstood. And I'd also love to understand the perspective of an atheist as well.
Well, a lot of questions. I'd like to preface all of this with, you know,
this is just my opinion.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can obviously only give it an opinion based on the limited insights that I have from investigating it, you know, generally.
Yeah.
I think that there is an infinite array of interpretations of what God may or may not be. And included within that is either an acceptance of it or a rejection of it. I think everybody has a notion of the concept of God, and one either accepts that in some way and is seeking the experience of it, or on the other hand, somebody has an understanding of the notion of a God or God, and is rejecting it for whatever reason. And they fall into that category of atheist. I can only really talk about this subject from my own personal perspective and experience. I've always had a sense of what we refer to as God. So, you know, right from a very young age, my parents weren't religious. I was baptized Church of England. But that was just because that's what the family did, you know, and that was the only recollection of anything religious that we did is, well, and I don't have any recollection of it because I was just a little fat baby that they dunked in the water. And I lived across the road from a Catholic school, and so it was the most convenient place for me to go to school. My sister and I went there, St. Michael's in Meadowbank in Sydney, and it was pretty tough for me because I really embraced this notion of God, and like as a really little kid, you know, I go to school every morning, and before I go and play handball in the playground before the school bells rang, which is what we all did, fierce competition, I'd always go to the church that was in the school, and I'd just sit there and
pray for forgiveness for what you're about to beat. Whip the asses of the other kids.
Oh, Lord, have mercy on them. Heal their sorrows as I destroy them on the handball court.
9-year-old.
No, I'm talking 5 and 6.
Yeah, wow.
Kindergarten, like very young.
Right.
I just walk on in there.
Yeah.
And it was
kicked
like,
their ass.
This was, and I'm talking about in the church.
Yeah.
I'd walk in, I felt very free walking into the church. And this was before I had any conception of what that place was. Or I knew that it was a place where people went to connect with God. And I was kind of already doing that. And I thought, well, you know, if there's a purpose-built house that you go and do it, then why not go do that? That's kind of groovy.
You were already doing that at 5.
Mm-hmm.
In what ways?
Just talking, you know, like before I go to sleep every night, I would be having a conversation with something that I sensed was all-pervasive, that was intelligent and was a governing force. That's the simplest way to put it. It had no face. It had no real personality other than just a warmth and a joy in my heart. It was just prevalent. It wasn't something cultivated. It was just there. And I don't have any memory of it not being there. And so when I went to school, being a Protestant in a Catholic school, and the school was run by nuns, they made it really clear that there were absolute constraints and limitations in the level of my participation of what took place there, at least religiously.
Right.
And I felt a sense of being ostracized. You know, that when everyone went up to receive Holy Communion, I wasn't allowed to. You know, my sister and I and a handful of others, you know, would just be kind of, everyone would get up and go down the aisle and whatever, and we'd just be sitting there kind of going, why can't we do this? You know, why doesn't Jesus accept me? and it always was, you know, very disturbing to me, because I was so devout in my own heart, not necessarily to a Christian God or, you know, the whole Christian way, but just, you know, I come here all the time. Why don't I belong? And so my relationship with the experience of God became deeply conflicted with the idea of God.
Right.
And what I started to realize was that they were actually, you know, two different things. You know, there's the experience and then there's the idea. And what was being taught at school was the idea of God. There was no evidence whatsoever that anybody that was participating in this whole procession that happened every week or twice a week or whatever was actually in any state of communion.
With on a direct experience level.
Yeah, like connecting. It just felt like this thing that everybody did. And the nuns were very cranky, verging on being quite mean. The head priest was very cold, hyper-authoritarian, didn't feel a sense of warmth from him at all, and was just very confused. I'm like, I don't understand. Like, for me, it was all very playful and joyful and light and beautiful. And so
Is that because in your direct experience, it was of what? Acceptance, warmth, love, and those?
It was just my spirit. Like that was my experience of this thing. It was a light, joyful, playful, beautiful, liberating force that I would take refuge in through anxiety, through sadness, through anger, whatever. I'd find myself just innocently taking refuge in this in this experience in my heart.
What took you to that place each time, or what made you aware that it was even there? Can you remember the first few times?
Nothing made me aware other than itself. It's all pervasive.
Right.
It's more odd when I lost awareness of it.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but
it
I'm
was
just trying
always
to
there. It's
relate
like,
to people that haven't had that direct experience, and particularly from a young age. Like, it seems to you have got the channel open.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
You know, because actually, that's my life's work now. Is you know, leading people to have the direct experience of this thing. You know. So anyway, to create context around the term God, in terms of how I use it, which is very rarely. As I went through the Catholic education system and felt increasingly more disgruntled with the preaching tone being completely mismatched with behavior, you know, the way in which what they preached, and they described Jesus's life and, you know, the relevance of his teachings and whatever, and zero embodiment. There was no embodiment from any of the teachers or the priests or anything. And I'm sure this was just, you know, this particular part of the world that I was living in. I'm sure there are really wonderful embodied Catholics in the world. And there are, and I know many now. But I had no experience of that. There was no kindness. It was tough. It was mean. And then I went to an old boys school, Maris Brothers, for 2 years. And I found myself increasingly feeling more isolated, alienated, disconnected, not belonging. And a series of events occurred and, you know, I was kindly asked to leave. I wasn't expelled, but I was asked to leave. And it was as a result of me questioning.
You had butted someone during war balls.
Yeah. Well, I got into a lot of fights. Yeah. I was constantly fighting.
Yeah, right. Why?
I was a bit of a bully magnet, but I also was one of those people that refused to be picked on. and so fought back and often, you know, was fighting back people twice the size of me and getting pummeled. But, you know, still high spirited nonetheless.
What a spirit.
You will not defeat me.
Yeah. And every now and then I get a sneaky put, you know, punch in that'd give them a cut lip or, you know, an eye or whatever. And then they go to the teachers and they dob me in.
Yeah, right.
And anyway, I earned a bit of a reputation as being, you know, a bit of a...
Hard as nails.
Whatever. Well, not so much hard as nails, just a troublemaker.
Yeah, right.
And actually, I honestly didn't feel like I was a troublemaker. I was just, you know, for some reason, I just kept attracting these guys that just... And they're all older, like, in, you know, 4 or 5 years older than me. And I just had one of those faces that they wanted to kind of, I don't know, they were very unhappy guys, you know, they were very angry and whatever, and they just went for me. Anyway, so I ended up having to leave that school and I went to a co-ed school and that was quite liberating. But after I left Morris Brothers, I couldn't say the word God. I couldn't. It would it'd give me almost a nausea, a sense of just it'd bring up so much stuff, and it was the concept or the ideation of God. However, the experience of God was still absolutely what we're talking about here, and I'm going to go to some length to describe what God is to me, so that you know the people listening to this can at least understand what I mean by that.
Yeah.
And I'm absolutely not referring to, you know, a white bearded man in the clouds specifically anyway, you know, because it can be that for somebody and that's fine. Anyway, I over, you know, my teenage years, you know, was quite agitated, let's say, by not only the hypocrisy of, you know, the institution, the education institution, particularly the Catholic education institution. I started to kind of pull back and look at the world and go, oh my goodness, everyone's very, very confused. You know, we're entrenched in hypocrisy, where people are saying one thing and doing another. I started noticing it with all the adults in my life. You know, not necessarily my parents. My parents were really, really wonderful people, really wonderful people. And so I had them as like a rudder and a reference point, but I noticed that most adults were terribly unhappy and that were projecting their pessimism and cynicism of life on us at school and whatever. And I just felt so disjointed and displaced. And that sent me on a very personal quest to discover what it was that I felt inherently that seemed to be missing in the experience of most people that I was encountering. And on the occasion, I would meet somebody who I felt had that warmth in their heart, and we'd just connect so easily and have that beautiful connection, and we'd be able to develop that relationship. And subsequently I developed very, very deep and beautiful and powerful friendships in my mid-teens that, you know, are lasting to this day, you know, really beautiful, powerful brotherhoods and sisterhoods, you know, with like kindred spirits. And we share a sentiment about, you know, the nature of reality and what's important, you know, about the expression of our humanity. So that was a bit of context to talk about, you know, what God is for me. And what God is for me is first and foremost an experience of my deepest nature. The word God for me is, or the concept of God is an all-pervasive, unified field of intelligence that conceives and constructs reality and has an omnipotent, omniscient and omnipresent consciousness that is simultaneously organizing everything that's happening in the physical and non-physical universe. And what that is everything. When somebody asks me, what is God? I say, well, what is God not? You know, for God to be God, in my opinion, it has to be everything. All pervasive. There's no way that it is not. It is the manifest and simultaneously the unmanifest. And so what does that mean as a human being? in terms of being able to have a relationship with this field of intelligence, it only requires that I develop a very deep and intimate relationship with the phenomenon of my own existence, to just become aware that I exist and to allow the faculty of self-inquiry to probe ever deeper into the nature of the experience I'm having right now. And this is why I'm a huge proponent of meditation, because meditation creates the conditions in my own nervous system and in my brain and my awareness state to develop sensory acuity, the sharpening of the senses to probe ever deeper into subtler dimensions of the experience of the present moment. And I've been very devoted to that for the last, let's say, 25 years. And what my senses have yielded yield right now as we speak is a knowingness of my very being as an eternal event. It's something that is a constant. There is, at the baseline of my experience of who I am, there is a constant knowingness, an awareness that I am. It defies conceptual understanding in any complete way. We don't come to understand the phenomenon of isness, of existence, through any concept, any linear concept. We can only know it through the direct experience. And that direct experience is something that finds its seat in my heart, in my chest, as an abstract sense of completeness. It's a wholeness.
That's a powerful, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the thing that I was feeling as a child that was non-conceptual, that was forced to become conceptual to some degree.
Okay, so that's the interesting thing, where how it comes up to the surface level or needs to be linearized or whatever.
Delineated. Yeah.
And that's in some effort what science is doing as well, to understand or give it, paint a conceptual picture that we can... is more universally tangible, because like anyone that has the deeper level of experience of reality, it's hard to translate.
Yeah, and, it is. Yeah. And science is absolutely extraordinary, as we all know, like every instrument that we're interacting with here to record this and transmit it to the world is all the byproduct of curious minds using the discipline of the scientific methodology. However, the challenge that science faces is that it's dehumanized. The very notion of subjective experience is a fundamental spanner in the works for the scientific process, because it requires objectivity. But what science is in denial of is the inextricable subjective experience of objectifying, because we only ever can be objective. This is a glass. Yeah. You know, we're being objective here. Both of us, we're looking at it. Do you concur? This is a glass.
Yeah. If I was that glass's state of consciousness, I'd be like, that's a couple of humans.
Yeah, exactly. And so how do we know that that's a glass? We can only know that that's a glass through the agency of our subjective consciousness.
Right.
And so whatever we are being objective about, we're using subjectivity, our own personal state of consciousness, in order to determine that's a glass. And so the scientific paradigm are in complete and utter denial. Not right across the board. There are a lot of emerging fields of science that are taking into consideration the principle of subjective consciousness and how that fits into the model of the physical reality, like to determine what the laws of nature are. What science is seeking to do is to define a unified theory of what the universe is, how it works, and what our role is in this. You know, and so this is a very contentious issue in this day and age, you know, being able to understand reality. You know, what science is hoping to do is to try and have an objective understanding of reality. I'm entirely convinced that in order for science to take the leap to truly understand the whole picture, they themselves have to explore the inner reality. And Einstein, for example, he knew this inherently, and he would constantly talk about the principle of imagination, which is what he's really referring to is consciousness, the inner landscape of his subjective experience, whereby he was able to have a direct cognition of the different laws by which he became famous for defining the theory of relativity. Mm. He would say that he would abandon linear thinking and just allow his mind to wander. Mm-hmm. And in that state, he would conceive of the law of relativity. He would be able to just perceive it. It wasn't just a formula of mathematical equations that were understood through some linear progression of an algorithm. Mm. It was a cognition, an experience in his own consciousness. His imagination yielded the dimensions of the law.
Yeah.
And he conceived of it within his own subjective state of consciousness.
That's amazing.
And then went about trying to create some sort of objective framework for it. And it was like two decades before somebody was able to do some sort of experiment where they were watching, you know, a star on the horizon line and, you know, they were to understand, you know, really whether his theory would stack up. And as it turns out, it did. It wasn't totally complete, but it did. But, you know, what most people don't understand is that he arrived at the insights about the nature of reality just by sitting gently, and one would call it meditation, and had a direct insight.
Mm.
And the reality is that all the great inventions, all of this arose in somebody's consciousness. They had a creative cognition. They had if I put that and that together and do that, then I could create that. Let's give it a go. Mm. All of the wonderful things that we see in this world emerge out of a subjective, abstract, creative pool that organizes itself on the level of our thinking.
It's so cool when you put it like that.
Yeah.
It's so clear then if you want to create or manifest from that deep, distill down to the very bottom and then see where it bubbles up from. Mm-hmm. But it's just your relationship to be able to explore that field and then manifest from. So you're kind of co-creating with the field of God, if you want to call it that.
Or the field of cosmic intelligence. I refer to God as, you know, cosmic intelligence.
Yeah.
And cosmic is a term used to describe everything on the most minute micro level to the most macro, the cosmos. It includes the most minute, you know, quantum particle of my physiology, all the way into the subtler dimensions of our consciousness, which we don't really have measurement for, consciousness is present, so we have to include it.
Mm.
So the word cosmos includes the subtlest of subtle consciousness experiences all the way to the most gross cosmological planetary phenomenon, you know, gaseous star.
Man, it's nuts.
And so cosmic intelligence, the word intelligence, is a word to describe the uniformity, the intuitive uniformity of the or the motion or the mechanics of the universe, what we conceive of as being the universe or the cosmos.
Right.
And so cosmic intelligence is an all-pervasive intelligence. And it's pretty hard to deny that the universe is intelligent and that it's computing capability is inconceivable to us on the level of our normal thinking and processing.
Yeah.
You know, just
and lifespan and perspective.
Yeah, exactly. There's no word for it.
Mm.
They're now speculating there is an immeasurable amount of processes that are taking place inside our physiology in every second.
Mm. Mm.
And the level of intelligence that's required to govern all the different processes taking place, like hundreds of trillions of processes.
Yeah.
There is some intelligence that's overseeing the whole thing and correlating all the different activities with all the different activities.
Mm.
And the combinations and permutations of variability of how one thing could do one thing and then cause an effect to all the other 100 trillion things, it's infinite.
Mm.
It's infinite. So therefore, we are governed by an infinite intelligence. And this is a mathematical fact.
Yeah, it's nuts.
That we're governed by, just our individual physiology is governed by an infinite intelligence. And so this was all really wonderful for me to discover, because it correlated with this intuitive sense that there was no end. It was boundless. Like when I allow my attention to connect with that wholeness and completeness, the experience is an expansion of self. It extends beyond my physical body. It extends into you, into everything I put my attention on. And I have a palpable sensation that everything is an emergent phenomenon of this underlying intelligence, and that this underlying intelligence has no end to it. It's infinite in its vastness, but it's infinite in its complexity and its intelligence and processing power. It's infinite in every conceivable way, in terms of time, space, in terms of processing capability, all of that. And so I was very fortunate to, when I first took my first adventure to India, to discover an ancient body of knowledge known as the Vedas, which is an ancient science of consciousness, which takes into consideration that consciousness is primary to all things. Our consciousness is primary to matter. Our consciousness is primary to our body. Our consciousness conceives our body. It's our mind and our consciousness state that determines the condition of our body and the condition of our world. It is the agency or the vehicle by which we are in relationship with everything that appears to be other than us. The fundamental premise within the Vedic tradition is to master one's capability to be in relationship with everything that is perceived as being other. And through developing intimacy in that relationship, the pinnacle experience is to actually have a merger where what is conceived of as other can be experienced on the level of the senses as extended self, as an experience of me. So the more I spend time with you and we become intimately acquainted with the moment and the reality of each other's desires to connect, and we fulfill those desires by listening to each other and creating a subtle framework by which we can connect, the more we do that, the more intimate we are in our awareness of each other, something extraordinary happens. The lines between our individuality start to blur, and we start to conceive of each other as the same thing. Mm-hmm. We start to recognize the subtler our awareness within the experience of connecting, being in relationship occurs, we start to recognize that we're one and the same thing. And this is actually, I would like to propose, the thing that every human being is craving. And so we don't diverge off the original question. Mm. You know, for me, God is the embodied experience of connection with anything and everything that I put my attention on, whereby I am able to merge with it.
So is it the process of love then?
Yes, it is the process of love, exactly. Mm. Yeah. And love is our nature. Mm. What we're desiring most is to connect as deeply and intimately with everything that we behold, anything that we put in our attention. Our deepest nature is to merge. So from the Vedic perspective, the game that we're playing here is the unity game. We have been indoctrinated into a way of being where our senses yield the reality of separateness. That reality is material and we are separate from each other. Mm-hmm. And the name of the Vedic game is to discover how to give life to the experience of unity, which is what we inherently feel in our hearts. We know we belong to each other. Humanity knows it belongs to itself. It belongs to the earth. It knows it. And we know this because when we violate that, we feel something very uncomfortable our hearts, our conscience. Yeah. This is why it's difficult to kill each other. Yeah. It's not easy to kill another human being. Mm. So when somebody else kills another human being, they have to be in such a distorted state of consciousness so removed, disconnected from their nature. And we see that happening everywhere on the planet right now.
And then this scale of that destruction or distortion, there's lots of different levels to that, all the way back to the just how we treat ourselves badly or treat someone else badly.
Yes, exactly. That's the extreme end of it, you know, taking somebody else's life or destroying nature. Mm. And in the subtler dimension, it's just self-loathing, feeling ashamed to be alive, feeling worthless, feeling unlovable. And these are all byproducts of being indoctrinated into a culture, a society, a way of being whereby that's the norm. So this creates the context for God from my perspective. You know, what's the role of God? What's the role of cosmic intelligence? The role of cosmic intelligence to define our why. You know, why are we here on Earth? What's this whole thing about? The whole experience of being human, as far as I'm concerned, is about fulfilling our deepest desire to actualize that experience of unity. And that is to connect deeply with each other, or with ourselves first and foremost, and then with each other. And in that process of connection, because it's a process, not an outcome, we don't just connect and then go, okay, we did that. It's a continuum. And in that process, recognize how we can serve each other to grow into deeper states of connection. Mm. And then to celebrate through the responsibility of belonging. And what I mean by that is recognizing that we are inherently of the same thing, and that when we disregard the needs of everyone and everything around us, and we're only serving our own needs, we're doing ourselves an enormous disservice. We will never experience true fulfillment in this life whilst ever there is acute neediness around us. And so that third principle of celebrating our responsibility of belonging is the act of being devoted to this principle that we belong to a whole thing. And to me, that's what God is. Mm. You know, when someone says, you know, I refer to it as being in devotion to the sacredness of life.
Mm.
But that could be translated to, you know, I'm devoted to the service of God.
Mm.
And again, going back to my original definition, God is everything. It's all processes taking place within the universe.
Mm.
And to what degree do I have an intimate relationship with those processes, and can I harmonize myself with them in order to maximize my capacity to connect with you right now and to grow with you, to share in what we're experiencing, to gain greater insight, greater capability, greater innovation capacity, to evolve the experience of fulfilling this desire to belong to it. And that's it. That's all it's really about.
Man, you're a powerful motherfucker. Seriously. Like, I feel like I love, to me, what it reads as is that you got a very true understanding of what reality is, what it is to exist, and you're honoring it. And kind of that's it.
Yeah. Like living it. Because what else is there to do?
Mm.
Live in anxiety, live in fear, live with self-loathing, live with a sense of unworthiness, a sense of powerlessness, which is what it really comes down to.
Yeah.
You know, the belief that we are powerless is the greatest human tragedy. And I dedicate my entire life to, as elegantly and as simply as possible, reminding as many people that are willing to listen that they are immensely powerful to create fulfillment in their life, and that fulfillment is something that is so simple and so subtle and available right here, right now, to experience. If they're willing to let go of the narrative, the delusion that they are powerless and that they are not responsible to the greater whole.
And you're saying it's a delusion because it's a surface level paradigm, or how would you?
In the context of powerlessness, a delusion is the belief that we are powerless to free ourselves from fear, feeling trapped. Powerlessness is just an idea.
Right.
I can't change the world. I can't liberate myself from my own suffering.
Yeah.
This is a belief. It's an idea that has nothing to do with the truth of what we are. the truth of what we are is that we are inherently love, and that experience is available just beneath the surface of the dissonance that's generated by the belief.
Okay.
When we're remarkable as creatures, where we can disconnect from our inherent nature, we can trivialize our nature.
Mm.
It's extraordinary.
Mm,
we can ignore it, forget it, deny it. And the only thing that's required of us to free ourselves and to become immensely powerful human beings is to stop ignoring what we are and make the choice to relinquish the delusion that we are powerless and to face the noise of unworthiness, of guilt and shame and sadness and pain and resentment and disappointment and all the things that we, all these feelings that we've accumulated through this life. If we're willing to face that noise and just move through it with a surrender, a surrender to a knowingness that our deeper nature is love. And because it's our nature, it's always there. It's always there. This is a truth that is available to absolutely everybody. We know it. It's just that we have become so entrenched in the belief that we're something other than that, that creates the dissonance in us, the discomfort.
And why do you think that's come about, this doctrine in our culture?
Ignorance.
Yeah.
It's a byproduct of millennia. I mean, from the Vedic perspective, you know, they have a very long calendar of events and they define the human existence within cycles or ages. And different cycles and ages create conditions for humanity to further discover and explore what it means to be human. And sometimes this part of the game is, all right, kids, we're going to turn the lights out. All right, here they go. And now just work out how to get around in the dark. And in the Vedic tradition, it's called Kali Yuga. It's an age of ignorance or an age of darkness. And we're in an age of darkness.
It's evolution then.
Yeah. It's all evolution.
Mm.
Everything is eminently reconcilable right now.
We're forever able to reconcile.
Correct. Whatever we conceive of as being irreconcilable is only a lack of dexterity of our consciousness. An unwillingness to surrender into the heart where the reality of unity is the dominant reality.
Mm.
And when we are fully surrendered to love in our heart, there is nothing that we cannot reconcile.
Mm.
And the only thing that stops us from reconciliation, from resolving, is a rigid attachment to a particular position. I'm holding
that's
a position.
That's the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing.
All conflicts in this world are generated and sustained by a rigid attachment to an ideology, a perspective or opinion. And it's only when we can let go of that, surrender to love in our hearts and recognize that we belong to each other as our greatest responsibility, will we be able to resolve. And the reality is that all the problems on earth right now are very easily resolvable if we can bring ourselves to let go. But that's our greatest challenge.
And why are the people that are influencing a lot of the control and structures, why are they so rigidly attaching, clinging on? Like, what is it in their nature?
Well, it's not so much in their nature that's making them do that. It's a condition.
Okay.
They're afraid. Fear is a powerful thing. Ignorance is a powerful thing. They're at a certain part of their evolutionary journey whereby they're really dominated by fear.
Do we change the person in power? Is it best to start with the collective, or is it best to go to the top and then drip feed outward?
Yeah. So
this transformation.
Yeah, I know what you're getting at. Yeah. And what you're questioning is probing what's the causal level of our societal dysfunction?
Yeah.
And should we be looking for individuals in positions of power that seem to be influencing culture and point the finger at them and go, it's you. What needs transformation is the way in which we are in relationship with ourselves and each other. Let's be very specific about what needs transformation. Yeah. What needs transformation is the quality of our relationship. And the quality of our relationships are always determined by our intention. Is my intention to love you, or is my intention to be strategic in the way that I can utilize this relationship to get something out of you?
I'd hate it if you did that to me.
Yeah, so I promise I won't. But this is what's going on. Yeah. Am I going to use you to further my way up the social status ladder, which is what we conceive of as being the most precious thing, social status.
Yeah.
We believe that that's where we acquire our power and our freedom.
Right.
And, you know, this is one of the greatest delusions.
Yeah. I can even personally relate to that. I'm like,
of course you can.
There's a big part of my brain that goes, oh, that makes sense because I can see it around me. Mm-hmm. So it's an obvious conditioning.
Yeah. But it's not true power. It's influence, but it's not true power.
Mm.
And generally people that are in power, that have gained their power through external status, are creating a big mess. And we've got countless examples of that.
Mm.
So what transformation is the transformation of our intent.
Right.
Am I going to use you? Am I going to take from you what I think I need? Or am I going to put myself in a position of service to the responsibility of belonging to you? With my intention to love.
So rephrase that, because I think that's a really important way to describe the sequence of intent.
If we shift our intention from looking at the world as something that is here to give us something, and this is why most people are very dissatisfied with life, is because they have an expectation for life to give them something, as opposed to what can I give the world? How can I be of service to you, world? And this is actually the source of fulfillment, is the way by which we are able to make ourselves a vessel to give, because that's all nature's doing. It's serving itself.
I love it. Even you just saying those words and me feeling the first one and then feeling the second one, my whole being felt lighter just by you actually spitting the words out.
Yeah, yeah.
Like just embodying the notion that I'm here, I'm a vessel to give.
Yeah.
Because I know that truth in me. I know when I've experienced that directly in isolation. I know when I've done it and felt it, and I know when I've not done it and felt the, I need to do something, you know, like I need to get, or even go so far as complicating the whole process and going, I think I'm given, but really I'm doing it to make myself feel better. You know, like there's a whole array of, it's cunning, that conditioning, you know.
It really is cunning and calculating and strategic, and it's exhausting.
Yeah, it's definitely exhausting.
And it's terribly inconsistent and it seldom satisfies us.
Yeah.
And all it's ever really feeding is an idea of who we think we are as opposed to what we are. Yeah. And what we are is love. And so when we transform our relationships by leading with the question, how can I be of service, with the intention to love, that refines the agency by which our intention is channeled. It's through our attention, the degree in which I am able to sustain my attention on you and continue listening, relinquishing the condition of feeling like I need to get something from you, and just sit with the desire to want to connect and grow with you and belong as the primary objective, then I am immediately liberated. I'm liberated from fear. I'm liberated from the anxiety of whether I'm maximizing this opportunity with you right now to get everything I need out of you to get to where I need to get to next. I'm just simply innocently being in this moment with you and allowing the moment to unfold and inform us more deeply of who and what we are. And it's a paradigm shift. It's a quantum leap from the way in which we normally operate. The way we normally operate is from a needy, desperate position, when we can relinquish that and just surrender in the moment to this notion that we have the capacity to have this extraordinary experience of deep connection and growing together and a sense of belonging. Now, to get to that point often requires that, well, it demands that we move into our heart. And the issue with this is that most of us are carrying around a lot of pain and stress and anxiety from the past, a lot of self-doubt and self-loathing and unworthiness. Moving into that discomfort, you know, it requires us allowing ourselves to be vulnerable for a moment. And, you know, vulnerability and the whole self-help movement at the moment, personal development, spiritual sort of thing, it's very trendy and it's great. And vulnerability is a very powerful thing to allow ourselves to experience. However, for those of you who are kind of like, you know, fuck vulnerability, you know, it's a phase transition. It's just like having to cross a very cold, chilly, torrenting river stream that feels a little bit treacherous and scary, but you have the ability to pass through that river stream and get onto the other side of the bank if you're just willing to brave the cold. And I assure you that there's somebody on the other side of the bank with a very warm, cozy blanket and a nice fire and some marshmallows or whatever it is that you find yummy that you can sit down and enjoy and start really being here in the moment. Mm. But you have to pass through that discomfort of getting into your heart.
And this is a very important sequence to understand the process of, because a lot of people I find, me myself included, we're looking for a practical way to find truth, find your own guide back to your heart, find an ability to discern between what is tripping me up and what is true, what I want and what I don't want. And like we said before, it's a very cunning, cloudy world of conditioning that we're in and ignorance that we're in. So it comes in all shapes and colors, and it's part of our mental framework, and it's really hard to discern the difference between what's real and what's not. And I get myself tripped up.
Yeah. And so this is where, you know, the practices of meditation and other beautiful practices come into play. They're exercises that strengthen the muscles of our true nature. And so it becomes easier to discern the difference between what is true and what is false. Meditation specifically is a beautiful practice that enables the mind to go beyond the level of thinking that governs our delusions and access directly a deeper experience of the self that transcends ideas and just completely imbues the senses with an experience of what the self is. Mm. And the more that we do that, our biology starts to transform the way in which our brain is structured in our delusion and dysfunction immediately starts to transform. It creates infrastructure to facilitate a perspective of reality that directly correlates with our deepest nature
right.
of love.
Yep.
You know, we can transform the brain so that it houses the experience of love. But we have to exercise that. And this is the original context of meditation, to deliver us into the direct experience of the self and to transform the hardware so it can run the software of love.
Mm.
But you've got to run that program. That it's almost like an antivirus scan. Mm. You know, we're scanning and dissolving the conditioning of the belief that we're not lovable, that we're not powerful.
Mm.
And so a really simple practice, which is, you know, very much expressed in great detail in my upcoming book, The Four Golden Insights, to be released in September 2018.
Very exciting. Is that the first time you've publicly announced that?
Yes, it is.
Good.
Yay.
I tricked you into it.
Yeah, you did.
Which I've read a bunch of, and it just lights you up. It's powerful, practical ways to sequence yourself back to a state of love.
Yeah.
And you've done it with me directly as well. Like, it's just that surrender and feel it and sit with it. And then by shining your eyes on it, it actually disintegrates the blockage.
Yes. Coming back to the original question, because I think we should, you know, put a bookend on it.
Yeah.
The concept of God, I described it as cosmic intelligence, as a label. Mm. But really what it is the experience of sacredness for me. And sacredness is anything that reflects back the truth of who I am, my true power to reconcile anything and to experience unity with anything, to see the sameness in absolutely everything and anything. And to me, that is sacred. And what I found on my journey of cultivating sacredness is that, as I said before, there's nothing that we can behold that we do not feel a sense of belonging to if we are willing to surrender beyond our defensive position of a thing and to allow ourselves to feel love. We have the capacity to have that experience. And to me, that is sacredness, this knowingness that we belong. We can discover that in things that are just absolutely immediate in our life. The beholding the rising sun, you and I got up quite early this morning to come into the studio and have this beautiful conversation. And we had the great value of crossing the street to go get some brekkie, and the sun was coming up. And we just took a moment, we stopped and we just looked at it, and we were so filled with its lights and just the magnificence of it. And it really matched the mood between us, the excitement that we were going to have this really great conversation and just our general spirit. It's reflective. It reflected back the truth of who we are.
Mm.
And this is prevalent everywhere.
Mm.
The easiest place to do it is with anything that we deem natural, you know, like trees, plants, flowers, birds, the sound of a bird, you know, a butterfly, even flies that we normally like, you know, just watching a fly and how they move around. Incredible.
Yeah.
You know, anything in nature, the way that the light is hitting the trees out there, if you just allow yourself to bathe your senses in natural phenomena, what you're doing is you're creating a circuitry with something that is going to feed you with the truth. So if you're feeling disconnected, overwhelmed, anxious, and no matter where you are, make a choice in that moment to let go of feeding and creating a circuitry with a line of thinking or a circumstance or an event or a person that is sustaining dissonance, and just direct your attention with the intention to love something within nature, and just allow yourself, your heart and your awareness to massage that relationship. And the more you do it, it only takes 30, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, a couple of minutes before you immediately feel this, at least some relief that reminds you of the truth that we belong to this immensely sacred reality, and that we have a responsibility to surrender our defensiveness and lead with love. We all have that power. And that's the new skill that we need to learn. And that is what I define as God, you know, is living it. Because that's all nature is doing, is it's seeking to serve itself. When we look at nature, you know, the biosphere, what an ecosystem is. It's a it's a whole bunch of different things living in harmony with itself as one thing filled of intelligence, serving and feeding itself to sustain balance. When we do something that violates this underlying field of intelligence, its primary objective is to sustain balance where everything has the vitality that it requires in order to progress forward in unison with everything else, evolving, changing, growing, expanding, belonging, changing. Everything in nature is doing that. And we human beings are the only, as far as we're aware, creatures on this planet that have the ability to ignore that responsibility.
Yeah.
And we're so powerful that when we are in ignorance of it, and we behave outside of the laws of nature, when we violate the laws of nature, we create an enormous dissonance, an enormous imbalance.
Which goes into the other beings, newborn beings and other people.
Animals, species. You know, the rate of extinction on this planet is mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. Thousands and thousands of species are going extinct every single day. It's like, I can't... You know, and some might say, well, you know, that's just nature and, you know, but a lot of it is anthropocentric, human-generated impact on the environment.
How do you process that knowledge?
Through my heart.
Yeah.
I wake up every morning and I feel the weight and the anxiousness of the world for sure. It is the reminder of my responsibility. It's what fuels me in the work that I do. You know, if everything was fine, I'd probably just live up in Byron Bay and be painting and, you know, surfing every day and just, you know, living a life of luxury and leisure. however, I feel an overwhelming sense of responsibility to be in the world, being a voice to nature, for nature, for our nature, a voice for love, to contribute to a solution that we so desperately need right now.
And then you just sense that as your responsibility. It's not like, because there's a part of me that goes, all right, if I want to enjoy my life, I should just go do the Byron Bay idea.
Yeah. The more love you feel, the more you become aware when others aren't. The more love you feel, the more sensitive you become to where it's absent, where it's not. And it gets to a point where there is nothing else you can put your attention on other than where can I channel love? How can I channel love wherever I go, whatever I go? How can I? Because it's the single greatest need of our time.
Yeah.
Single greatest need is to be an agency of love, to be embodying that fulfillment and capability to connect with people and to grow with them and to be a support for each other. Mm. And to reinforce this understanding mm. that we have a responsibility to each other.
Mm.
And, you know, I can't conceive that I'll be resting until the day I die because I don't necessarily see, you know, this work being done in my lifetime. I mean, humanity has got a long way to go, you know, I think.
Mm.
You know, if I can contribute to bringing us back from the brink of total annihilation, then, you know, I feel like I've contributed something, something great. Mm. I don't, you know, necessarily conceive of world peace as a reality in my lifetime, because world peace is a very complex thing that requires very high states of consciousness, you know, of a large group of people. However, if I can increase the peace, increase the level of love, increase the level of capability to sustainably coexist on the planet, then, you know, great.
Mm.
And that's what we need to just be putting our attention on. And most people tend not to participate or listen to their sense of responsibility because they feel defeated. They're like, what's the point?
Mm.
It's so messed up. The world is so messed up. Mm. We need to shift from that outcome orientation to just process orientation. It's not about an outcome. It's not about world peace. It's just about this moment right now.
Mm.
And if we want to change the world, we need to change it right now. And what transformation looks like is shifting our intention from what can I get from you to how can I serve you?
Mm. It's massive.
It's as simple
and
as
so
that.
Simple.
Yeah. And it's eminently achievable right now.
Yeah.
And everyone can do it right now.
And how much do you take? I think that's fucking awesome, that just that sentence in itself. It's so simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
You, as an individual, you're choosing to make this your work and you're choosing. And so while it's nature flowing through you, it's also your choice. You know, like we've got will in this, haven't we? Or do you feel like you...
Well, the more, like I said, the more love you feel, the more you feel where it's lacking. And I consider myself choiceless.
Right.
I would have to expend a lot of energy to ignore what I'm feeling.
That's a really interesting way to say it.
My will is thy will. You know, it sounds corny and kind of biblical. But when I say thy will, is thy will of that field of cosmic intelligence. It's acquired me fully. I surrender completely to it. I only ever want to live in accordance with it, in harmony with it, never in violation of it. Because a violation of this inherent, the laws that govern our humanity cause great dissonance in me, an anxiety, a pain, you know, you know immediately when you're stepping out of the parameters of what is conducive to greater harmony and connection. And unity. And so I'm choiceless in that regard.
That's beautiful. I love that you see it that way.
I mean, there was a period of time where, you know, I was having to choose deliberately to let go of certain things, certain resentments that I was harboring towards the world and things in my late teens. You know, there were things that I had to kind of let go of, where I had to exercise my will. So we do. But once you break down those damn walls, it starts to flood. The will to serve is like a relentless torrenting surge that, you know, you try and stop it. You can't. I can't stop this.
So powerful. So I feel like we've acknowledged, or like at least spoken to, the space of people who believe in what God is in their perspective. Can you speak to the other side of the world of non-belief in this entity or misunderstanding of what that entity is?
Mm-hmm.
Because I know personally, I have a few friends that don't believe in God, but are very, what I would deem, spiritual or good people. We don't need a God for ethics or morals.
As far as I'm concerned, whether you believe in God or not, it's not really relevant to the deeper fundamental need right now, which is to choose love, to surrender to love and to understand intimately what that means and what the responsibility of that is. we don't require a belief in anything in order to actualize our deepest nature and cause an effect of greater connection and unity. Mm. It's self-evident, the value of that. Mm. Whereas, you know, the principle of faith is not always self-evident.
Right.
They're different things. I believe that the experience of unity enlivens one's inherent faith if you are faith-based. And for those that don't have a belief in God or an underlying in supreme intelligence of the universe, that doesn't preclude you from love. Mm. We all know what love is. We all know what it means to connect with somebody deeply and to feel that powerful connection and sense of belonging. And that is the most fulfilling thing that we can experience as human beings. And that's what we need to nurture. Mm. So the notion of God, from my definition, is an experience of love and unity, because that's my perspective. Other people have different definitions of God. Mm. And I don't think that talking about God in any absolute way is going to do us any service right now. Yeah. And I think that talking about God in any absolute way is actually the root cause of some of the really big problems that we're facing, that we're facing in the world right now. Yeah. And what we have is our humanity, and all we need to do is honor and nurture that and let nature take care of the rest. Juicy.
Juicy. It's so good. I thought we were going to talk about an array of different things, but like I like that this whole conversation can be around one thing that gives someone a different perspective on something they may not have had before.
Yeah.
Or they can learn a bit more about.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what we just discussed is probably the most relevant thing to people right now that are trying to make sense of their existence and find deeper meaning and create some concepts, establish some concepts in their mind about how to move forward. Mm. I think it's practical.
You bring it in a way that's very beautiful, non-judgmental. It's like your expression of nature is, I'm just so fond of it.
because it's inclusive. Yeah. And loving in isolation, it's like an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Loving with exclusivity, it's an oxymoron. You know, love is all inclusive. Mm. And what we're seeking is the liberation of unity, the liberation of belonging, knowing that we belong, and to feel okay about our differences and to feel powerful enough to reconcile them. Yeah.
Oh, man. You're the best. I want to have you like on my shoulder, a mini version of you, always in my ear. But that's kind of what you are in my Voxer app.
I can pick away at your dandruff and just snack.
Well, thank you, Johnny. Massive love and appreciate. And anyone that wants to follow you, just Google Johnny Pollard and you'll be able to find him on any channels. But his book that's coming out next year on 2018 is going to be Growth Evoking.
Thanks, mate.
You'll facilitate our evolution. Thank you for doing it.